Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I have with me today Jack Ferguson. Jack is a law clerk on a federal appeals court. He received his law degree, summa cum laude, from Notre Dame Law School and earned his BA from Notre Dame's Great Books program, which is called the Program of Liberal Studies. Jack has published several articles in law journals, and we're specifically talking today about his piece called The Ciceronian Origins of American Law and Constitutionalism, published recently in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So at some point last year, this piece of yours that we're talking about was mentioned, I think, in the newsletter from our friends over at the James Wilson Institute. And we immediately thought, who is this guy? Because the intersection of Cicero's legacy and its impact on the American framers is of tremendous interest to us. And while we're not an organization committed exclusively to studying Cicero or the American framers, we want to encourage both as much as we can. And when we saw your article, and we had to get you on the show, it does a great job of demonstrating why I think this is a worthwhile endeavor. But I don't want to take that observation for granted. So let's start with this question: why do this at all? Why should those who are lawyers, judges, law students, clerks, why care about classical authors like Cicero? Why did you particularly care about this?
Right. Yeah. So why should lawyers in the 21st century or any in the public, care about this, 2000 year old Roman philosopher? So one reason I started caring so much is because I noticed that members of the founding generation, those in the 1700s, certainly, for decades and nearly a century into the early Republic, lawyers, politicians, jurists, writers, journalists, they all cared about Cicero, and they cared about him deeply, and they had studied him, and they sort of wove his thought and his writings into much of their work. So, as someone who I'm a lawyer, I care about, what is the law of our founding, and how to what extent is that still our law today? Since we care about what they thought, well, I thought, they really cared about this guy. So, maybe I should look into why they found him, such an influential thinker.
Well, I think there's also something to be said about, at the American founding and before that, there's no law schools, right? Law schools are a thing that come, late 19th century? Is that?
Yeah, it's much more informal. There were some colleges that would have, general sort of lectures on law. So James Wilson,
right,
founding father and early Supreme Court justice, gave a series of, famous lectures on law, just sort of about general jurisprudence. But yeah, they didn't have, all sorts of formal law schools in the way we think about them today. It could be an apprenticeship. It could be just sort of diving right in and, learning how to practice law and, just like we do today sometimes.
But also I think, just reading Cicero in a way is kind of I've actually seen get your MBA in this book, right? It's the only book you'll need, right? Or something, or
yeah.
Get your law degree in this book. Cicero can't be that, but, certainly back then, your law school was, whatever you could get your hands on in terms of whether it was Cicero, Blackstone, Coke, others, that was what they did. And so trying to understand the founders, I think without understanding these folks would be difficult. Now, but one of the challenges here, and I you recognize it in the article, and I recognize it throughout this paper, because we're talking about the founder's debt to Cicero, and we're exploring how a philosopher statesman of the ancient world influenced these men almost 1,800 years later. But this creates some methodological challenges, as you observe. You know, how do you untangle the Ciceronian line from, say, that of the English common law tradition, or from more explicitly religious thinking, and so on? Because I could see at times where you said, you know, this was the influence of Cicero, and I thought, well, that could also be this person, right? Maybe, but you seem to anticipate some of that, right?
Right. So I think it's very, you know, in this sort of, you know, trying to trace back a chain of title of a certain, you know, line of thought or a certain idea, it's definitely important, you know, upfront to recognize that, you know, these ideas, you know, they, you know, evolve over the centuries, and they go so far, you know, so many of these ideas of natural law, or what is the law of nations, or, you know, what is the role of reason in law, you know, these kinds of questions, they go very far back. And, behind a lot of the founding generation, there's Blackstone. Behind Blackstone, there's Cook. And, well, who's behind Cook? Well, you have medieval English jurists. And a lot of these questions can really be traced, though, all the way back to Cicero, who was, the primary expositor, not the only one in the classical world, but I think for many in the Anglo-American legal tradition, he's sort of the most prominent and one of the most developed, you know, writers on you know, legal philosophy and natural law, and government and constitutionalism. So, you know, he wasn't the first by any means, you know, and you know, every, you know, the founding generation recognized that. But, you know, behind him, there were other philosophers to whom Cicero took his ideas. But the way he sort of synthesized it and brought it together, you know, it was sort of, his stature is sort of unique, in the, you know, subsequent European, you know, in the Enlightenment, those ages. He sort of takes on a unique stature in sort of bringing all those questions together. And they also respected him, I think, particularly because he had been in government himself. He was a lawyer, you know, he prosecuted cases. He was a public official. He was in government, and he worked his way up to become the head of state of Rome. So he had both the theory and the experience, and he was able to bring that together in his work.
Right. By the way, before I move on any further, so I say Edward Coke. Did you say Cook?
Yes.
is that the right way to say it?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, dude, I'm today years old figuring that out. I have a PhD in political philosophy, and I'm calling him Edward. You know what? I'm it's the show's over. Just kidding. Oh man. Well, I'm going to go with Coke, because if you say Cook, I'm going to get confused. Anyways, you're right. I'm wrong.
I'm sure there are many people today who refer to him as Coke.
that's good. So yeah. And I think, just going back to Cicero, I think, you know, there's so much to be said about, I'm going to assume that our audience is, in just for the sake of time, I'm going to assume our audience knows some of the basics of his life before we dive into this article. But I think it's really important to note that, you know, two things, that not only was he, you know, he was experienced public official. He rises, you know, as you said, through the cursus honorum, and, you know, goes from, you know, all these different levels and steps, something that Hamilton, you say in the paper, relates to as well, Alexander Hamilton. But he also is, he's often criticized, I think unfairly, to a point that he's not original, right? That he's more of a popularizer, a conduit of Greek thought to the Latin speaking world. And I think it's important to note that, you know, just like anytime you translate something, it's an interpretation. I think the same thing is true with Cicero, right? So he is this conduit, but there's pieces of him all over this, which could be a good and a bad thing, right? I mean, Cicero has his flaws. He's not exactly humble. For example, he definitely can, he can land a joke, but he can't take one, right? I mean, there's definitely, you know, some of that there. But
he was human. Yep.
Yes, it turns out he was human. And I'm grateful for that. Now, let's get into the article then. So I am one of the reasons I'm grateful for this article is the sources you provide. It's just a treasure trove of references that appear throughout. A lot of interesting trails we could go down here. One of the things to note for our listeners, if you don't know what the Catilinarian, did I say that right? Catilinarian conspiracy. Mm-hmm. It's a little late at night, listeners. So this is late for me. When looking how Cicero was how he was received, and where his life and work impacted later thinkers, what surprised you in this investigation, if anything?
I was really just I was taken aback by the sort of breadth of. The scope of what people considered him, you know, influential on, and sort of how many people, you know, used his ideas and learned from him, and they quoted him and they cited him. They, you know, they used him in private writings. They used him in public writings. They used him in treatises. They used him in, you know, like legal work. Hamilton, you know, cites Cicero in his legal briefing when he was litigating state court cases before the Constitution was ratified. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just over time, I sort of just began noticing, you know, how many people both, you know, sort of across time periods and across countries were just finding themselves and declaring themselves deeply indebted to Cicero. So you've got the sort of continental Enlightenment tradition. You've got, you know, international law writers in Germany and France and Switzerland. You've got those like Cook and Locke in England. You know, you've got those, you know, later like Blackstone and Lord Mansfield. And then you've got the founding generation in America. And then you've got, you know, the first several decades, at least the first half of the 19th century, you know, American courts are still citing Cicero as a legal authority. So I was just taken aback, you know, by the sort of, you know, breadth of what they considered him for. And so that's, you know, how I came about to start writing this article. I just started taking notes of any time I'd see a Cicero citation or a, you know, a particular line of thought that was picking up on his work. And I eventually ended up sort of compiling it. I sort of think that the article is like, it's, you know, like you said, it's sort of like a source compilation of here's, you know, you know, I don't think I was exhaustive, but, you know, here's all the times and all the things that people invoked Cicero for and why they thought he was, you know, had something to say.
Right. Well, his influence is so ubiquitous, which is a reality that's lost in us here in 2025. But I like this line on page 34 of my copy. I don't know if that's the right page in the actual final published version, but you write that Cicero has been a victim of his own success. To borrow from Stephen Sacks, minimizing Cicero's influence here would be like, quote, accusing Shakespeare of being full of cliches now that our own language is defined by his turns of phrase, end quote. You know, through the 19th century, people don't even cite him. I mean, and before this, right, long before this, people don't even cite him. They just quote him. Right.
Right. No. So, yeah, no. So that's honestly part of the difficulty I found in tracing this, because so many times I would find Hamilton or some other, you know, founding era, you know, lawyer or jurist, they'd be paraphrasing Cicero or citing him, but without attribution, because it was just second nature to them. And Cicero's, you know, philosophical vocabulary and his legal vocabulary had so infiltrated, you know, I think the Latin West and the Anglo-American legal tradition, that after a while, it just becomes second nature and people don't even realize, or, you know, maybe they did, but, you know, centuries later, we don't, you know, how steeped their language and their thought was in Cicero's thought.
You know, I didn't think about this till just now, and it would have been, you know, if you encounter this, it would have been tangential to this particular essay. So if you don't have an answer, don't worry about it. But do we know if the sermons of the era, like some of the religious writings and pamphlets and the non-legal stuff, right? Especially sermons. Because yeah. I know that some have, you know, they've done studies on how John Locke, for example, ends up in a lot of political sermons of this era. Is there any feel that Cicero ends up there too?
You know, this is not my specialty. I'm aware of some scholarship in this field. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any specific examples, but like you said, Locke was going to be the first place I would go to. Locke has all sorts of writings on religion or religious thought. Another example I think that comes to mind is that early American clerics in the colonies would often sort of mix religion and politics in some of their speeches leading up to the American Revolution. And I can think of one example where a prominent New England clergyman was, railing against the British from the pulpit on Sundays, and worked in some references to Cicero as well. But that's definitely a field, because Cicero's thought touches on,
Everything.
the sort of philosophy of religion, the philosophy of God, all those things, and how they tie into the world. So
I think it, and I could be wrong here, but isn't it Cicero who essentially coins the term religion, right?
that would, I'm not aware of that, but I would believe you.
I don't. I mean, I could, listeners, Google that. I don't know if that's true or not. I remember. I vaguely remember a professor in grad school saying that, the discussion of religion didn't really exist until Cicero invents the word. And I never looked to, I never challenged him on that. I just thought that was mind blowing. And so I went with it. Well, I don't want to get too caught up in that, but I hope if someone's listening, you're thinking about a paper for a future Ciceronian Society conference, that'd be a really interesting one. Cicero in the founding era political sermons. All right. Now, part two of the article deals, and this is more your bread and butter, right? The law of nature, law of nations. This is a huge topic, and you could, this could fill volumes. So what are some of the key concepts that inform Cicero's legal thought specifically, and how it impacted international law and the early American legal tradition? Again, you don't have to say everything you wrote in the article, but just give us some of the highlights here.
Sure. So, two themes that run throughout many of Cicero's writings, right? And he's got philosophical dialogues, he's got his letters, he's got his public speeches. So, two themes, I think you see very prominently in his work is the idea of the law of nature and natural law, and the concept of right reason, what in Latin is recta ratio. And Cicero is one of these early philosophical developers of the idea of this law of nature that is sort of antecedent to human law and human institutions, and it sort of undergirds human law and political society. He's not the first person to say things like that. There's a whole you have the whole school of thought with the Stoics and the Epicureans, and you've got all sorts of things before him, but he's certainly one of the most prominent writers on this subject. And so he sort of lays, I think, the philosophical groundwork for subsequent medieval law. There are treatises citing his work, and then once you get into the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, you have these international law jurists like Grotius and Vattel and Pufendorf and people like that citing him. At a basic level, Cicero's law of nature, you've got these basic principles. So, a person has a right to self-defense. A person has a right to life. A person, you apply that to nations. So this becomes the law of nations. You have the natural law as applied to nation states. So nation states have a right to, self-defense. They can go to war under certain circumstances. So Cicero has ideas of just war theory and things like that. And so that's what these many of these international law writers are picking up on in later centuries, in the 1600s, 1700s, things like that. In the American Revolution, you start to see that reflected in appeals to the law of nature and the right of revolution. Blackstone, in his commentaries, is paraphrasing Cicero almost directly when he speaks of the law of nature. Alexander Hamilton is then quoting Blackstone in his famous pamphlet, The Farmer Refuted, which is one of these very famous, very celebrated, colonial letters about, what are we doing here in the American Revolution? How are we justifying, our revolt against the state, against the British? So, you start to see the, Hamilton is quoting Blackstone. Blackstone is quoting Cicero. You start to see these sort of chains of title develop in the jurisprudential lineage.
One of the So there's different lines we can think of here when we think of the history of law, and I'm not, I mean, this is totally, I'm not qualified to talk about this at all, but you think of the kind of the continental tradition, which kind of can point back toward Roman law and the tradition of Roman law, whether, you know, via Justinian, I think that's who it was, right? In the sense that there's this long tradition, and that America draws on the English common law tradition profoundly, right? That's the big influence here for the American legal history, if you will, right? So where does Cicero fit in that? Because is it English common law plus Cicero, or is Cicero, you know, embedded in that English common law tradition in ways we may not realize?
Okay, good. So a couple things. So yes, Cicero is very much a part of the sort of European continental civil law tradition, along with other Romans like Justinian. You know, there's a lot of there are many Roman law roots of the European tradition. We sort of think about, you sort of separately have this Anglo-American path, traveling for, the centuries. And Cicero is very much embedded there, his thought in a deep way. There's someone I know who's working on a PhD thesis right now about how Cicero's thought was, picked up by English common law writers even before Cook. So it's people that, writers that most people don't even know about, people like Bracton and Glanville, these sort of, primeval, medieval English jurists were basically quoting Cicero in their writings on how the what is the reason of the common law, right? Now, Cicero talks about reason, recta ratio. So the common law, as the Anglo-American tradition understood it, is this sort of artificial reason of human experience worked out over the centuries. So, there's sort of there's the human reason that, any two people getting together can work through, but then there's also the artificial reason of, centuries of accumulated experience and tradition. You've tested what things kind of work around here. So you've got these multiple traditions, but then, it's you don't want to think of them too separately either. There are several scholars. I think Richard Helmholtz is a famous one who's discussed the sort of cross-pollination between the European legal tradition and the Anglo-American legal tradition going back centuries. But then also, even by the 1700s, English lawyers and American lawyers cared very much about, some of those French writers and the German writers I was discussing earlier. So Grotius and Vattel are two of the most, commonly cited legal authorities in the colonies. They're cited by the Supreme Court in the early years, and so to the extent that they're embedding Cicero's thought into their work, it's also traveling, being sort of smuggled into the colonies, into the early American Republic.
Well, one of the interesting ways, the case study you end this particular part of the article with, that surprised me, and you write that Cicero's writings on law directly contributed to the formation of American judicial review. I've never encountered that argument before. So how did you get to that specific observation?
Right. So the field of studying the origins of judicial review is a it's a huge topic in the law, and I, there's so much that can be said about it. I, barely scratched the surface of even going into some of that. But one little piece that I noticed, which I don't think I've never seen this in the literature anywhere, but so Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 78 gives what's considered one of the most famous defenses of judicial review, which is the power of courts to hold a statute, to hold legislation unconstitutional because it conflicts with the Constitution. So there's this whole idea in early American law that legislatures would be able to pass statutes and that courts might not be able to hold those statutes unlawful. There's many people who adhere to that idea. So judicial review for a while is fighting an uphill battle. The idea that the Constitution is supreme law and courts just as much as legislatures sort of get to interpret the Constitution and say what that is. So Hamilton gives this very early defense in Federalist 78 he argues that the Constitution is supreme law. Legislation, a statute, is just ordinary law. It's ordinary law passed by the legislature. The legislature is set up by the people, and the Constitution is set up by the people. So, you know, both ultimately answer to the people. So when courts are deciding cases, they have to decide whether the ordinary law or the supreme law will govern if there's a conflict. And so Hamilton argues, well, it's natural that the supreme law will displace the ordinary law if they conflict. And so a court will rule that the Constitution, whatever provision it is, you know, supersedes the statute, whatever provision it is, if they conflict. And so, you know, this, again, this seems, I think, very intuitive to the modern listener or even to many modern lawyers. But, you know, this was not at all taken for granted in the 17 and 1800s. And so I noticed that Hamilton's language is very similar to this formulation from Cicero's writings on legal interpretation. And so this goes back to what we were saying earlier, you know, how people, I think it was just Cicero was so, you know, the founding generation was so deeply classically literate mm-hmm. that they could quote him or cite him or paraphrase him without second thought. And it would be, you know, probably obvious to many readers what it was like. So Hamilton doesn't quote any authority or cite any authority in the Federalist, which makes sense if you think about it, because they were writing those off at lightning speed. You know, they wrote them in a matter of weeks for publication. Mm-hmm. So it struck me that I think Hamilton is quoting Cicero in the Federalist. And then sure enough, I found out that Hamilton, in some of his earlier legal works, when he was just a lawyer litigating cases in the 1780s, when he had more time to sit down and work through his authorities and cite authorities and his legal briefs, he was actually citing Cicero, quoting him for the exact same proposition that when, you know, two laws conflict and there's an unavoidable conflict between two laws, you go with the more fundamental law. Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of a basic rule of legal interpretation that Cicero is setting out. And Hamilton takes it and sort of transforms it into a rule of adjudication. You get this insight into how they were thinking about the Constitution as fundamental, you know, sort of the deepest law of our republic, and how statutes are ordinary law. And so that was sort of my contribution to helping think through the ideological origins of judicial review.
Good. Now, again, staying on this theme of kind of fundamental, we could say law, but also principles. Part three of the article wrestles with Cicero's republicanism. And for our listeners, we don't mean the Republican Party here, but we mean republicanism as this long, long tradition of political thought and how it impacted the structure of government at the American founding. You focus especially on John Adams, James Wilson, James Dickinson, and Alexander Hamilton, of course. But when we say Cicero's republicanism, what do we mean by that specifically? What do you mean by that, and how it informed the founders?
Right. So, like you were saying earlier, you know, every act of translation or you know, retransmitting old ideas is sort of an act of interpretation, and it's a new act of presentation of those ideas. So Cicero, you know, is not the first person, obviously, to deal with, you know, sort of deep questions of constitutional structure and you know, how do we structure our governments? Plato writes the Republic, you know, years before him, and Cicero is quite explicit in, you know, citing his own influence to Plato many times. But, you know, Republic is a Latin word; it's not a Greek word. It comes from res publica, which means, you know, the public matters or the people's thing, the people's affairs. And Cicero is really credited with sort of coining and popularizing the term and the concept of the res publica, the republic. And in fact, he's so successful, there's a reason we call Plato's Republic the Republic, which is a Latin word and not a Greek word. You know, we don't call it Plato's Politeia, which is, right. You know, what the Greek word would have been. You know, so in his dialogue, so he's got these two dialogues, the De Republica on the Republic and De Legibus on the laws. And in these two dialogues, Cicero is trying to think through this sort of the most fundamental questions about where does government come from, and then how do we actually structure governments? What's the best way to do it? And he intertwines that with sort of historical analysis of, well, how has Rome done it? You know, what would be the best way to do it? How has Rome done it? What can we learn from theory? What can we pull from our experience? Turns out he thinks the Roman Constitution is pretty great. So a couple of basic elements. One, Cicero believes in popular sovereignty. So the res publica is the people's affair. It's the people's matter. So he thinks at some level that political authority does come from or rest on the people. And, you know, this is a complicated subject. There's a lot more that could be said, but at a basic level, he thinks that, you know, political authority rests in some way with the people. He also believes in the classical mixed constitution. So he's picking up on Polybius and other writers who wrote about the classical mixed constitution, which was a way of thinking about the structure of government that combined forms of democracy, aristocracy, and monarchy. Or, you know, we would say rule by the many, rule by the few, and rule by the one. And Cicero was trying to think through, and he made, you know, early arguments for why having, you know, certain structural arrangements could preserve stability, preserve peace, and ultimately create the conditions for, you know, human flourishing in society. So those ideas are sort of what he's laying down in the De Republica, and I think you can see how that some of that is very appealing to the founding generation later on.
Well, I think it's important to point out, though, and you do this in the paper, is that much of what we have today of the De Republica, they would not have had yet, right? It's not a huge chunk of it isn't discovered until the early 19th century in the Vatican, and then but. As you also point out, right, there are a lot of secondary sources from which, and primary sources, right, frankly. So you have a lot of quotes of the De Republica and say Augustine and other places, Lactantius, we also have the, you know, Scipio's dream, which is a major part of the De Republica, right? It comes down, I don't know. You know, because that they had for a long time, right? That did not get lost. Am I right in saying that? Right.
Right. Yeah.
And then a lot of these same ideas are also in on duties.
Yes.
Probably arguably his most influential piece, the one used in so much of education for, you know, 2,000 years. I wanted to bring up in this discussion of republicanism this notion of. Because a key piece of republicanism, right, is civic virtue and personal character as being critically important. Depending on who you talk to, right? Even at the expense of or in contrast to the importance of institutional design. Thinking of Cicero and the American founders, and I think this is an important question when we're thinking about the founding and Cicero and the relationship. Are we choosing between the two in terms of emphasis? Would they have recognized this choice, right, between an emphasis on personal character and virtue and civic virtue on one hand and institutional design on the other? You know, is Cicero more in one camp and the founders in another, or are they on the same page? Where did you land on that question?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think they, you know, sort of thought of these dichotomies in some of the way that modern scholars sometimes present it. So there is no doubt that, you know, Cicero's writings on morality and virtue, you know, in the De Officiis are just deeply, deeply important. So, you know, John Locke, in some of his writings on education, he says that the first thing, you know, all young people must read for their moral education is Cicero's On Duties. Mm-hmm. You know, Lord Mansfield, the Chief Justice in England later on during the Revolution, he says, you know, the first thing all young lawyers need to read is Cicero's De Officiis. So they you know, they cared very much, and their sort of sense of morality and virtue was very much influenced by Cicero and you know, others in the sort of Greco-Roman tradition. Mm-hmm. So my my sort of angle was not to contradict any of that, but just to sort of, you know, help maybe with the swing the pendulum back a little bit. I think there are certain camps of thought today, that think that, you know, the certain members of the founding generation and, you know, some of the sort of Roman philosophical tradition in the 16 and 1700s, was very much concerned, you know, only with republicanism as virtue, and they didn't really care, you know, it was about persons and your sort of personal morality and how people worked. And they didn't think so much about institutional structure. Mm-hmm. And ways of putting governments together that might not depend entirely on whether you had a virtuous citizenry. In some cases, you know, how do you structure government to with the recognition that many people aren't virtuous sometimes? Right. So, you know, so I think in Cicero, you see, you know, and I'm not sure he's totally given credit for this, which is sort of why I was trying to swing the pendulum back a little bit. Mm-hmm. You see how he really cared about how government was structured. He thought it made a difference. You know, he thought institutional design mattered. And that's very much what you see, you know, with James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and people like that thinking through, well, how do we, you know, structure this constitution, you know, in a way that recognizes that people aren't always great.
right.
So that was what I, that's the angle I was sort of picking up on there. Cicero cared very much about institutional design. He thought it mattered. And I think the founding generation recognized that and they believed him.
Well, in keeping on that theme, then institutional design, part four, you turn to executive authority specifically and the design of the executive, which of course is fraught with controversy at the founding. They spend most of their time at the convention on the legislature. Then they wrestle over the executive branch, and then they just kind of, at least in my view, they don't spend nearly enough time on the judiciary, at least not yet. They'll do that in the first Congress, but. You're saying this actually, this surprised me. I didn't see this coming, but you're saying that Cicero is a main inspiration for the idea of an energetic, but also, which that kind of makes sense to me, right? Given his role in the Catilinary conspiracy and other functions, but also as a unitary executive, which coming out of the Roman experience, especially the Roman Republican experience, that struck me as counterintuitive. So you're saying kind of he's informing Hamilton and others there and Wilson's view on this, right? Is that the executive needs to be unitary and energetic?
Right. Yes. So to a certain extent, and I should clarify up front that in this area, I think the sort of historical evidence is the thinnest. There's ample historical evidence for, the other things we've been discussing, sort of law of nature, international law, republicanism, the mixed government, those things. So the sort of thought of Cicero and the executive is not something that many people have looked at or talked about, and with some reason. So the evidence here is not quite as strong as it is for the other subjects we've discussed. But I think my point is the evidence, there's not no evidence of this. And so I was just sort of trying to tease out and flesh out some of this evidence on how in sort of small ways, the founding generation were giving some thought to Cicero, you know, and his sort of his thought, but also very importantly, his practical example on executive authority. So, you know, right. Cicero was not just, you know, writing about political subjects. He was also leading Rome through civil crisis and civil war. He was, to the founding generation, one of the, you know, most famous, you know, Roman consuls, heads of state. He suppressed the Catilinarian insurrection while he was the consul. And so they had both his precepts, but they also had his example of what strong executive authority looked like. Do you want me to go into a couple examples, or did you have other questions?
Yeah, I mean, you can, well, yeah. Actually, I think this I can relate this directly to our conference and our personality. The Whiskey Rebellion, right?
Right.
Hamilton's response to that, he actually takes Cicero's nickname Tully as a pen name in defending the government's reaction to that. So without going into too much detail about what the Whiskey Rebellion was, right? It's Western Pennsylvania. They're mad about taxes on whiskey. I mean, who wouldn't be? But their response is, you know, they're going to fight this, maybe even secede, and Hamilton and Washington come down pretty hard on them. And so you're saying that, especially in Hamilton's letters here, written under the pen name Tully, are kind of evidence of this argument, right?
Sure. Yeah. In a way. So Hamilton, you know, this is one of the, you know, early tests of the federal government's authority and the federal government's ability to respond to crisis. You know, the colonists had just, you know, thrown off a government earlier, a couple, you know, in 1776. So, you know, why not do it again if we don't like what the feds are doing in Washington?
Right.
You know, this is also the day of horse and carriage. I mean, if you've got some angry farmers out at near Pittsburgh in rural Pennsylvania, it's not exactly easy for the early fledgling federal government with, you know, to respond to that. So what Hamilton's trying to do, he writes this series of letters called the Tully letters. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of like how we wrote the Federalist under the name Publius. They were always taking classical pseudonyms. And so Hamilton takes the name Tully and writes these letters basically defending the idea of the whiskey tax and defending the sort of legitimacy of a you know, sort of show of force and the executive's response of wheeling out the militias and marching them off to Pennsylvania to put this down, which, you know, was not foreordained that was going to work, or that everybody would accept it, or how people would view that as legitimate. So he sort of deploys, you know, sort of Cicero as cover to say, hey, look, you know, we can have a strong central government. We can have an executive that uses force to quash rebellions when those rebellions are unlawful and against our constitutional order. And so, you know, that sort of, he's trying to use it to shore up his legitimacy. And it's just telling that that's Hamilton. That's who Hamilton chose as his pseudonym at that point.
It's interesting. For those who have been to the conference, we forgot to do it this year here in 2025, but in previous years we have what we thought was the flag that the Whiskey Rebellion people made. And we would, well, not the original, obviously, but we had the, we'd have the hospitality suite at night. So we're having some drinks, including whiskey. And so we'd put up the Whiskey Rebellion flag. That was just our thing that we did. But then we found out last year that we've had the wrong flag all this time, like that it was a fake, that the design that we had thought we was right, that someone was selling online as the Whiskey Rebellion flag was wrong. And so Bill Batchelder found the real one and he had it made. We forgot to put it up this year, but if you're coming to 2026, we're going to remember that. So definitely be, I mean, obviously the rebellion against government, that's a longer conversation. We should do a podcast on that, but by the end of this paper, and I want to close with this question, cause I think this is a tough one. And I get the sense that you're thinking this through the paper as well, because, and by the end of the paper, I'm thinking, why does Cicero carry any weight or authority with these people at all? Right. And because yes, he's a great writer. And in many ways he defined what it means to be a great writer. I mean, in that sense, but here's the problem. Apart from preventing a coup, he ultimately, I mean, I think we could argue in one sense failed, right? We can't put the failure on his shoulders. Obviously, I think that's unfair, but this enormously influential figure, and I agree with you, he's enormously influential. He clearly carries a substantial amount of authority, despite the fact that he's someone who ends up in exile and is assassinated by the very republic he tried to save. So one of the things that strikes me as interesting here is that this, you know, it's not right to call Cicero a loser, but he did, in a way, he doesn't end up on top, right? He ends up on top briefly, but he's not, you know, why follow or why look to someone like this despite the fact they failed? Now, as a Christian, you know, I follow someone who was crucified. So I think there's a difference here, but he, you know, in this sense, Cicero is on a different level here. He doesn't rise from the dead. he fails in some ways. And so where do you think his authority comes from? Why could someone appeal to Cicero and expect their listener to give that any weight? Does that make sense?
So he dies, shortly after the second triumvirate is formed. You know, Mark Antony basically adds his name to the list of prescriptions, and then he's trying to leave the country. And a group of soldiers find him and execute him. That's pretty much how the Roman Republic falls. And after that, you get the triumvirate, and then Caesar Augustus for a long time, and you've got the Roman Empire. So I think, the way Cicero's life ends, it's, I think he's seen in many later generations as this sort of the last sort of spokesman of the Republic and sort of this patriot, in a sense, almost a martyr for, Roman republicanism and the Roman constitution, because, he ultimately dies for, what he believes and what he stood for. It's telling that, Caesar Augustus is sort of part of the triumvirate and the movement that, overthrows the Republic, which Cicero stood for. They have him executed. But, later on in life, Caesar Augustus, he finds one of his grandsons reading one of Cicero's books, and his grandson sort of hides it out of fear, oh no, this was the sort of, forbidden fruit of the old days. And Caesar Augustus, tells him, no, my grandson, it's okay. This man was a true patriot and a sort of a true emblem of the Republic. Mm-hmm. You sort of even get this admission from the emperor, this sort of respect for what Cicero stood for. So I think that's sort of how he's seen later on. And then you put that together, with what we've discussed, how he was both a philosopher and a statesman. So he had theory, he had practice, he had ideas, and he had practical experience. He wrote about law and he also practiced law. And so, through his whole life, he's this dual threat. It's this feedback loop of his experience, his unique experience informing his writings, and then sort of him putting his own writings, or at least trying to, into practice. So I think that, sort of unique wedding of those two elements, Plato or Aristotle were not leading nation states themselves. And, most people who lead nation states aren't, first tier philosophers in their own right. So the fact that Cicero is both is pretty impressive. And I think that's why he's part of why he's so appealing to the American founding generation, because that's in a way what they were trying to do themselves. They were practicing lawyers. They were lawyers and politicians and, businessmen and journalists, but they also cared very deeply about ideas and about the basic and most enduring questions of human nature and law and government. And, we study the sort of the philosophical thought of people like James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and Joseph Story and James Wilson, John Adams. In a way, we said Cicero is a victim of his own success. I think part of why Cicero is not so much studied in the American tradition anymore is because these people, the sort of founding generation, they sort of pushed him out of the way and sort of began occupying the pedestal themselves of being, political theorists and also political craftsmen. So I think, I think that's why he holds such a special place for them.
And I think, in some ways you could argue too, that his, and I don't know if he would say this himself. I don't think he would, but given his arguments about natural law, in a way, people who appeal to that, even when they're not saying it, they're also appealing to this kind of, what's the word, like a universal sense that we all tend to share. That, this, from a Christian standpoint, right, we're all made in the image of God, so it would make sense that this law written on the hearts of all men and women across the world and across time, there's going to be an authority to it, because it appeals to something internal that we all share. And so I think in some ways, Cicero is authoritative in some ways because he's so good at articulating that, right? He's not fighting nature entirely, and he's not right about everything. I won't say that. I'm with St. Augustine on a lot of this stuff, but I think that's part of why he's authoritative to a point, maybe. But
no, absolutely, he's tapping into something universal about human nature and human experience and about the world. Which is why, you know, I think they, his ideas, you know, if they're universal and if they're tapping into something universal, it's why they still, you know, carry so much weight, you know, 2000 years later, or, you know, a century and a half or a millennia and a half later. Yeah.
That's great, man. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jack. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to talk.
All right. Well, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. If you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th, 2026. Paper and panel proposals are due September 1st, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. And topics related to this would be great, kind of in the spirit of Russell Kirk's Roots of American Order, thinking through the long inheritance of examples and thinking that inform what the American framers accomplished. Given the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, we're going to lean into that heavily. And so I encourage you to kind of take Jack's lead here and follow him back to these sources that inspired the American founding. All right, be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.